Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest and most brazen mendacity displayed by House Republicans who in their latest spending bill are gutting money for IRS enforcement and for the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, crippling their ability to regulate derivatives and other toxic swaps. William K. Black, the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who put hundreds of crooked bankers in jail after the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s, joins us. Then we'll go to India to get an update on the US's divorce from Pakistan and the Obama administration's efforts to woo Pakistan's arch rival, India. Christine Fair joins us. She's a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and is a leading specialist on India and Pakistan, which she often visits and where she speaks the local languages. Then finally, in advance of tonight's presidential debate in Mexico, we will speak with Joan Grillo, a correspondent for Reuters in Mexico City, where he has covered Mexican politics since 2001 and is the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. We will discuss what changes may come if the pre-candidate wins and how the PRD candidate, López Obrador, would approach the failed war on drugs. Joining us now is William K. Black, who is the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s. Currently, he is a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and he was the executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007, and is the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. Welcome to Background Briefing, William K. Black.
Thank you.
And this latest mendacity, brazen as it is from the Republicans in the bill that was unveiled last week, the House Republicans in their latest spending bill would severely cut the budgets of the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, which would keep it from regulating derivatives, refused to give the Securities and Exchange Commission the extra money it needs to carry out the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill. And it would also cripple the IRS's ability and limit its ability to detect tax avoidance, particularly by big business and the wealthy. Do you have any outrage left, Bill? Or I mean, I'm just reeling here from how in your face it all is. I mean, this is where the rubber meets the road, isn't it? Money for enforcement.
So we could talk about it in terms of philosophy, economics, and criminology. In terms of philosophy, Ayn Rand said it was critical for the government to prevent fraud. Ayn Rand. And these folks want to gut the anti-fraud efforts. I mean, so they are so far. I mean, Congress, the Republican Party, in the House in particular, has gone so berserk that, you know, they would treat Ayn Rand as a communist in the modern era. So that's philosophy. It's just astonishing thing. Second in the economics. Well, first part of that, we just went through a crisis largely driven by fraud in which the SEC and the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, the CFTC, were deliberately gutted. Now, the CFTC was gutted by a bipartisan effort of the Clinton administration and Phil Graham, a Republican in the Senate, and another Republican called Alan Greenspan. And that produced an absolute disaster with the Commodities Future Modernization Act. And so the provisions of Dodd-Frank are designed to at least partially undo that disaster that helped drive a crisis that cost just the U.S. household sector $11 trillion. A trillion is 1,000 billion. And so we've learned absolutely, or at least these people in the House have learned absolutely nothing from the crisis. They want to produce another disaster. And that brings us to the criminogenic part. And with our criminology hat, this is precisely what you would want to do if you wanted to create elite white-collar fraud with utter impunity. And they got pretty close to impunity already, you may have noticed. But the SEC at least brings some civil actions, and it has led at least to some vigorous insider trading action. they're going to deny the resources the SEC would require to continue to bring any serious actions. And in doing so, it is an open invitation to the fraudsters. So on all three levels, philosophy, economics, criminology, this is so far beyond insane that when I first heard of it, I thought it was a joke.
Well, the Republicans in the House are proposing to cut the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. These are the people that oversee these toxic swaps and derivatives. And we only had just recently an example of J.P. Morgan Chase losing up to $5 billion, literally vanishing into thin air in some shaky trades that they made in one of those offshore branches, in this case in London. The CTFC budget is currently $205 million. Obama wanted it increased to $308 million. And now the House wanted to cut down to $180 million. And this is at a time, as I say, when we've just witnessed supposedly the smartest guy on Wall Street, Jamie Dimon, his outfit, losing $5
billion. Yes, and, what we also saw is the things they're calling hedges aren't really hedges and would violate the Volcker Rule if the agencies actually adopted a rule consistent with the intent of the legislation. So we already have relatively weak regulation because both parties put in regulators determined to make sure that the agencies fail. But Gensler has actually turned out to be reasonably good in a number of areas.
That's Gary Gensler, the current head of the CFTC, who actually comes from Goldman Sachs.
That's correct. And he also was one of the supporters of the Commodities Future Modernization Act. So a number of us were very skeptical, and he certainly hasn't covered himself with glory in the MF Global stuff. But, in general, he's one of the stronger Obama financial appointees. Now, Obama has had very weak appointees, but
he wasn't able to stop the run-up of the price of gasoline a few months ago that just literally raided the pocketbooks of the average American and added 40% to the price of gasoline by many estimates.
And therein lies part of this story, precisely because the CFTC did propose to get better in information processing ability so that it could go after, first identify the people manipulating these kinds of commodity prices and bring actions against them. And it was specifically in that context of that proposed spending that, and this is months ago, that the House Republicans first reduced the budget of the CFTC successfully to try to prevent any action against the speculators, raising not just the price of gasoline, but food commodities. And when you raise food commodities, you kill people, not necessarily in the United States, but certainly in many countries.
So, again, I'm speaking with Bill Black, former litigation director for the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. He investigated the savings and loans disaster of the 1980s and was responsible for putting hundreds of bankers in jail. He's the executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007 and the author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. The cynicism of this is pretty. I think, as I say, it's quite brazen. Do you think that there'll be? Is there any outrage left? I mean, I started out by saying that because I just don't know that this is translating. I don't see it translating into the presidential debate or the race. Is anybody going to ask Romney, how he feels about this?
Well, Romney has already said that he would promptly repeal the entire Dodd-Frank legislation.
Oh, well, so he's on board with this. What about Obama? Has he said anything about how this basically is putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank?
Not as much as you would hope. There's some general language saying, look how wonderful the Dodd-Frank bill is. But the truth is that, again, both parties just got together. Now, there are two things called the Jobs Act. One is a very good idea to put people to work. The second one was a complete scam to give away to the worst, most fraudulent parts of the industry. And that was the Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act.
Right. We discussed that at the time.
That's right. Is what Obama is most known for recently in connection with both the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Commodities Future Trading Commission. So both of those things cut back the SEC's power to prevent fraud. So Obama has positioned himself very poorly to be the person, going after things. So
he rolled on that, though. But if he's asking to up the enforcement money from 205 to 308 million, it's not a lot of money for a federal budget. It's infinitesimal.
It's chicken feed, and by the way, they're also doing this to the IRS for the precise purpose of preventing them from going after tax cheats in the ranks of the corporations and the wealthy. And that will net, of course, cost the government money. So this has nothing to do with saving money.
Sure, these are the deficit hawks at work here, right? They say that we have a terrible deficit. The way to get rid of a deficit is to increase revenues. The way to increase revenues is to close up the loopholes and make the rich and the corporations who dodge taxes pay their fair share. And now the Republicans are cutting the ability for the IRS to do that. So
that's correct, but it's even worse than that, because if I'm honest and pay my taxes, and the cheaters don't pay their taxes, and they're able to get away with it with impunity, then the honest businesses are driven out of the marketplace. So it is an obscenity that places like the Chamber of Commerce are in favor of these laws. Remember, this is all about law enforcement. So let's say that we did the same thing with regard to street crime. Well, let's just cut all the police departments out, right? And then you have a disaster. And you go, well, it's a free market and such. People would treat you as insane if that was your proposal. But in the white-collar sphere, so far, and it isn't, again, just the Republicans. Both parties at substantial time periods have allowed elite white-collar criminals to get away with becoming wealthy through fraud. And Obama has his last chance in the run-up to this election to come out as the champion of the law and honesty and allowing honest businesses to prosper instead of the most fraudulent businesses to prosper. And I will tell you, prosecutions on financial crimes under the Bush administration were down by more than 50% from 20 years ago. And you know what? They've actually fallen further under the Obama administration.
Well, but you were famous for putting people away, putting them in jail after the savings and loan ripoff of the 1980s, Bill Black. And my understanding is that when the massive fraud was taking place during the Bush administration that led up to the bursting of the housing bubble, the subprime ripoff, while that was happening, I think following 2001, September the 11th, I think the FBI's, most of their white-collar people were diverted to anti-terrorism, weren't they? Wasn't there a huge lack of anybody minding the store?
By this experiment, 500 FBI agents over time were transferred from doing white-collar to national security, which was a substantial reduction. and there was only a pittance of folks available to deal with. Remember, September 2004, the FBI warns, one, there's an epidemic of mortgage fraud, and two, predicts it will cause a financial crisis if it's not stopped. So an epidemic, it's going to cause a financial crisis. What do? They put about 30 FBI agents.
Well, let's do the math on this, though, just to put this in the context of what the House Republicans are now doing by gutting the budgets of the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and the IRS's ability to enforce tax laws and detect tax avoidance. The kind of money it would take to put some extra FBI guys in back then to look into the white-collar crime epidemic that the FBI had warned about before the subprime bubble burst, we're talking, what, a few million dollars?
Yeah.
As opposed to what did the meltdown cost us? Has anybody given?
Just in the household sector, and just in the United States, $11 trillion.
Lost.
And a trillion is 1,000 billion.
Right. So for a few million, maybe we could have saved ourselves a few trillion.
Yes.
Well, there you have it.
The evidence, and what happened is that Alan Greenspan refused to act. So you need two things. You need enough people with skills, and of course you need the will. The Republicans are attempting to make it that even if you get somebody with the will to prosecute, it won't happen because they simply will not have the resources. And that, again, will hurt not just all of us who will be the victims of the fraud. That will hurt every honest business in America. So where are the honest businesses? Why are they not in revolt against this as well? This is an absolute obscenity that is going to destroy any ability they have to compete with the dishonest firms. We call it in economics and criminology a Gresham's Law dynamic in which bad ethics drives good ethics out of the marketplace.
Well, in closing, do you think that there's, I just assume, that we live in a rational society, that, the country was founded during the Age of Enlightenment, that there's still some brain cells ticking out there, there's still some objective truth, there's still ability amongst the American populace to do some critical thinking. Do you think this is going to resonate, what's obviously going on here?
Without leadership, right? So when is the last time you heard the President of the United States or the Attorney General say, we have an epidemic of elite corporate fraud, and as a national priority, we must go prevent this, and our opposition is attempting to allow the wealthiest frauds in the history of the world to grow wealthier still by sending the nation back into an even worse Great Recession and harming every honest business in America.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, William Clay Black.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with William K. Black, who is the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. He investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s and, as I mentioned, put hundreds of crooked bankers in jail. Currently, he's a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and he was the executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007 and is the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and go to India.
Get from out the road when he get dough, it's horrible. Time is money, spend, wait, save, invest, a fest. The 10K cave, a chicken chest, S. Yes, y'all, a double get your trickles. The best ballers pitch in and rub to get a nickels. But tut tut, he about to change the price again. They go up each time, he blow up like hydrogen. Villain here, album's shrilling in fear. It won't stop Tom Bill until he a gazillionaire. Took a Jehovah money for Arabic Torah. Charged in advance, translated and ignored us, sorta.
Oh, my dear.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now from India is Christine Fair, former United Nations political officer. She's a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include Treading Softly on Sacred Ground, Counterinsurgency Operations on Sacred Space, The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, the Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And thank you for staying up, and we're very grateful for the time you can spend with us. Is there a divorce going on between the U.S. and Pakistan, and is the Obama administration wooing Pakistan's arch rival, India?
The U.S.-India rapprochement has been really ongoing since 2000 and before, so there's really nothing new. In the Indo-U.S. relationship, if you recall, in 2005, under the Bush administration, there was the U.S.-Indian civilian nuclear program. So, the U.S.-India relationship no longer keys off of that Pakistan relationship, but the U.S. it's impossible to understate the degree to which the United States government, across virtually all agencies dealing with Pakistan, is in fact utterly exhausted and fed up with Pakistan.
So, but the fact that the Defense Minister, Leon Panetta, had a press conference in New Delhi where he castigated the Pakistanis over safe havens, et cetera, and first of all, what was he in India for? He was trying to get some agreement.
But like I said, the Indo-U.S. rapprochement, it's been ongoing since 2000 and before. So that's not where the news is. The U.S.-India relationship has been on a steady glide path. We've been, this has been perhaps the only success of President Bush's administration was that he was able to really recalibrate Indo-U.S. relationship. The real story is not what he did or did not say in India. The real story is about the degree to which virtually every single agency that handles Pakistan in the United States is really done with Pakistan. In the last several months, I can't tell you how many people have said to me from a variety of agencies representing DOD, as well as the State Department, that says, I don't think the Pakistanis realize how close we are to bombing them. And this is a sentiment that is continuously relayed. And so the India thing is not something that this is a sort of here shiny. It's a distraction. The real issue is what's happening with the U.S.-Pakistan relationship. And what I think is kind of interesting is the Pakistanis keep banking on how important they are. But what they've kind of missed is that the Americans really have come to the conclusion that they don't need Pakistan like they thought they had. And so this kind of gives the Americans a lot more leverage. We're not bending over backwards to pay whatever exorbitant price to get the ground lines of control open. We're continuing to use drones and, in fact, expand drones, even though domestically they're very unpopular. The U.S. has basically said to Pakistan, in so many words, you're part of the problem. You're not part of the solution. And everything that Pakistan has done, literally over the last year and a half, has demonstrated Pakistan's commitment to be part of the problem, not part of the solution.
Well, I think the Secretary of Defense in India, and he was making jokes about how the U.S. kept the Pakistanis in the dark in the raid that killed Osama bin Laden. I imagine that didn't that sort of bridled the Pakistanis, but and of course he's critical about the Pakistanis working with the Haqqani network. That's not new in as much as...
But this is nothing new.
Exactly.
For crying out loud, Admiral Mullen,
right,
in one of his final swan songs last year, over a year ago, said that Haqqani was a veritable arm of the ISI. So I think it's easy to get spun up over what Panetta said, where he said it, but the real issue is these are things that have been said to the Pakistanis before. And the thing that's so frustrating is that it doesn't matter how you tell the Pakistanis this. They continue sleepwalking through this dream of their own importance. They have not gotten the memo that the United States government is sick and tired of their nonsense.
So,
if it takes Panetta saying that from New Delhi, so be it. But the Pakistanis are utterly resistant to this message.
Again, I'm speaking with Christine Fair, former United Nations political officer and a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. She's talking to us from India. Now, things have changed, clearly. I mean, you mentioned the ground routes that supply all of the war material for NATO and the U.S. in...
They don't supply. That's the point. Yeah. That's the point that Pakistan should have missed, is that we have found a way to work around them.
Right. Well, that's what I understand. And now the one big concern was that there's so much NATO material that has to be moved out of that country, heavy material, weaponry, etc., and that there was a concern that if the Pakistanis didn't open that up, that this material may be left behind, like all those rotting Russian tanks. Now, apparently a deal has been struck with the stands, right, to get all of that stuff out.
Well, I see the Russians have kind of resisted using the northern distribution route for lethal stuff, but the fact is a combination of the northern distribution route and moving things through air. We've really kind of obviated the need for Pakistan. And, of course, the Pakistanis don't seem to get this. They keep howling, well, if you pay us some ridiculous sum of money, we'll open the geolocks. And the Americans are like, I don't think so.
It went up from, what, a couple of hundred per vehicle to 5,000? That was...
I mean, it's absurd. And so, you know, what is very interesting from my point of view, as somebody who's been watching this relationship now for a really long time, well over a decade, is that for the first time Americans are realizing that actually the Pakistanis need us more than we need them. They are an economic basket case. At some point, they're going to have to go back to the INF. Now, that's when the United States is going to have a really interesting opportunity. Typically, the U.S. forces the IMF to go back and make some deal with the Pakistanis that everyone knows they're going to renege on. Increasingly, there are people, including me, who say, actually, we should let the Pakistanis fall flat on their face, because why should the IMF keep coming in, cutting these deals? Why should the American taxpayer keep subsidizing Pakistan's elite, because they don't want to tax themselves? And this has been the persistent row with the IMF. The Pakistanis don't want to expand their tax net. They don't leave aside the tax debate in the United States and how appalling it is. But in Pakistan, the parliamentarians who have themselves elected refuse to enact either an agricultural or an industrial tax, because most of their wealth and that of their patrons come from agricultural and industrial income. Can you imagine anything more absurd? So, you know, the United States, I think, is really coming to a position where it's deeply frustrated. It understands that what Pakistan wants for the region is injurious to our interests, that we don't need them as we previously did, and we have a lot more room, just in the same way that the Pakistanis are renegotiating their relationship with us and on what terms, we're doing the same thing. And what we're really kind of concluding is that Pakistan is more, quite frankly, looking like an enemy than an ally. And this is something, you and I, we've discussed this for years now, but finally multiple agencies, including the U.S. Congress, have really come to this conclusion independently.
So the idea that there may be some way to open up the supply routes through Pakistan into Afghanistan, which have been closed since 24 Indian Pakistani soldiers were killed on a border skirmish, which the Pakistanis are insisting on a U.S. apology. Obviously, in this political year, in a presidential election, with Mitt Romney already trying to define Obama's foreign policy as a foreign policy of apologizing, there's no way in the world that Obama is going to apologize, right? So. Is there any way that this apology thing? Right.
I mean, this apology thing, I think people have taken this out of its context. First of all, every time some soldier, looks crosswise at some Afghan, there is an apology. So this idea that the fact of the matter is the U.S. was predominantly at fault during that Salhala strike for a number of reasons. But whereas we will readily apologize to the Afghans for any number of trespasses and defenses, The issue with Salhala is that Americans genuinely feel that the Pakistanis have been taking our money and supporting the Taliban, who have been killing our troops. Our troops aren't being killed by Al-Qaeda, they're being killed by the Taliban. And so even though there is a consensus within those who know about the Salal attack, that the U.S. and, you know, in NATO, but primarily the U.S. is at fault, there's a sense have the Pakistanis apologized for the Haqqani network attacking the U.S. embassy, for the 1,500 or so American troops that have been killed by the Taliban. And so, in some sense, the anger on the U.S. side about Salalah and the refusal to apologize is cumulative, stemming from 10 years of Pakistani perfidy. The issue of the apology itself is quite frankly puerile. I mean, we apologize to the Afghans for any number of offenses that are not nearly as egregious as this. But the point is, no one wants to apologize to the Pakistanis because they have taken $22 billion from us to support the war on terror, when in fact they were indeed supporting the war on terror, primarily by supporting our enemies. And so the discussion about the apology or lack thereof will often get cast into this issue of Romney versus Obama. But to do that really does violence to the very deep-seated multi-agency anger about Pakistan that's really, at this point, it's become impossible to manage. You know, in previous years, like, Congress would be pissed off. The Vice President Cheney was furious for a while. Elements of CIA would be ticked off. Parts of DOD would be ticked off. But there would ultimately be this interagency decision to keep on kicking this can down the road. What we see now is that people are just not willing to do that. There is just a genuine sense, and I don't entirely support it. To simply write Pakistan off and disengage would be counterproductive. But that is where this interagency process is right now with Pakistan. Because you are actually on radio and you're subject to certain rules, I can't actually give you the direct quotations, but how my interlocutors describe our position vis-a-vis Pakistan typically involves a lot of verbs that are expletives.
So would this extend then to any kind of courtship of India in a military sense? I mean, the Pakistanis are paranoid about India's activity in Afghanistan. India has made some substantial investments in roads, etc. there. Their embassies have been attacked by the Haqqani network, obviously in league with the Pakistanis. Is there any... is the U.S. talking to India about the post-2014 withdrawal of NATO from Afghanistan?
We've been talking to the Indians for years. We have a very robust strategic dialogue with the Indians that's inclusive of military dialogue. All of our services do exercises. We have a joint working group on counterterrorism and law enforcement. We routinely, we now have FBI legal attachés. I mean, the relationship that the U.S. and India enjoy, as I said, has been built up since 2000, i.e. before 2001. Obviously the Indo-US nuclear deal got a lot of press, but there were other deals on, for example, satellite launch technology. So our relationship with the Indians is driven by a sense that India and the U.S. have joint security concerns in the region, only one of which is Pakistan. I mean, the principal driver of our relationship with the Indians, quite frankly, is China, sea lanes of control, piracy, global commons. It is true that in the recent years, as the United States has come to view Pakistan differently, the U.S. and India have had a convergence on our understanding of the role that Pakistan plays in the region. But I also want to emphasize that if you look at the Indian government, there is a tremendous amount of discord about how they understand the Pakistani threat and how to deal with it. So I'm really pushing back on this idea that Panetta coming here and saying what he said represents something new in Indo-U.S. relations. It actually represents a continuation of a long-standing, slowly accumulating robustness in U.S.-Indian ties about security in the region. Now, speaking to the issue of Afghanistan in particular, since you raised it, the Indians themselves are having a pretty big debate about after 2014, the Indians, like the Chinese, they're essentially free riders under the U.S. security umbrella. So they're asking themselves, what are our strategic interests in Afghanistan? What kind of presence do we have to make to manage our objectives? And so the Indians themselves are having a fairly complicated discussion about what its options are and what their costs and benefits are. You know, on the one hand, you know, the U.S. has tended to see India's role in Afghanistan as uniformly positive. You know, I don't necessarily see it that way. But the fact of the matter is India is an extra-regional power. It has interests in the region. Pakistan is not an extra-regional power. It's an extra-regional nuisance. So, you know, from the U.S. point of view, do you continue to indulge Pakistan's paranoia? Do you continue to accept Pakistan's excuses for its behavior? Or do you simply let the regional dynamics play out on their own? And right now, I don't think this is not something that multiple, you know, the interagency process has really kind of figured out.
Well, Christine,
what is the ideal role of India in Afghanistan? I don't think there's an answer to that yet.
Well, Chris Fair, I thank you so much for joining us. We ran out of time, and I appreciate your staying up late in India to talk to us.
It's definitely my bedtime.
Yes, okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, former United Nations political officer. She's a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University, and she's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the Mexican presidential elections and the big debate tonight. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Mexico City is Joan Grillo, who is a correspondent with Reuters. He's covered Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time Magazine, CNN, the Associated Press, PBS NewsHour, the Houston Chronicle, CBC, and the Sunday Telegraph. He's witnessed military operations, mafia killings, and cocaine seizures, and has discussed the drug war with two Mexican presidents, three attorney generals, and the U.S. ambassador in Mexico City. He's the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joan Grillo.
It's good to be here.
And the debate, of course, a much-anticipated television debate, takes place this evening in Mexico City. It feels like the pre-candidate who has been avoiding any public exchanges and any real media scrutiny. He's been supported by the two big television monopolies, Televisa and Azteca, essentially anointed as the next president. But it feels like there's a kind of an insurgency underway, a popular insurgency against the idea that the Mexican elite is imposing this president on the people.
Well, that's an interesting way of putting it. There certainly has been a recent upsurge of popular opinion against Peña Nieto and against the PRI and their, you know, how they ruled Mexico for 71 years continuously from 1929 until 2000. Now, this has been led by the students, and we saw this eruption of student demonstrations starting in the private university, in the Ibero-American University in Mexico City, when students confronted and heckled Peña Nieto. And then after he criticized them and said they were just like, provocateurs, then after that, you know, he criticized them and attacked them. And there was then very large demonstrations with more than 40,000 people in Mexico City. And basically, these protests are really a reaction to the idea of a kind of authoritarian rule, the system generally. In some ways, this is kind of a Mexico's expression of the world demonstrations we've seen in the last 2 years with the Occupy movement in the United States, Los Indignados, or the Angry Ones, as they're called in Spain, the Arab Spring over in the Middle East. Some of the kind of Mexican artists, they identify with being part of that world movement, and they kind of feel a reaction to the system generally, the idea of very rich, very corrupt politicians, you know, having extravagant houses and a bank accounts with millions in them. And this also reaction to the TV company, the dominant TV company, Televisa, being particularly targeted as being a symbol of the system, a symbol of the system which has kind of kept the people down.
So does this mean that if the students are kind of calling out Peña Nieto and the PRI, is that sort of trickling down to the broader population? My understanding is that the broader Mexican population are just exhausted by this war on drugs that's cost 50,000 plus Mexican lives, and they're quite susceptible to the notion that somebody could end it, even if it may end it on the terms of the criminals as opposed to the state.
Well, that's a very good point. There's certainly a lot of people who are very fed up of drug violence, very fed up of the military steaming into neighborhoods, kicking down doors, having shootouts with, you know, gangs of criminals, and feel that the PRI, for all its downsides, will be better at handling the situation and better at bringing peace to their country. And that's the kind of PRI central message. You know, we will fulfill our commitments. You know, they haven't addressed very openly the drug war. None of the candidates have. It's in a way, they're living in a bit of a different country from the place of the drug war. It seems like none of the candidates see a real political gaining talking about the drug war too much. But the kind of message of the PRI is, you know, we'll restore peace to Mexico, we'll restore prosperity. But when you're talking about general the population of Mexico, like any population, you know, in a large country in Mexico, you have about 116 million people. You have all kinds of different regions, different social classes, and different groups with often different points of view. So if you look in Mexico City, there's definitely been, in the capital here, more of a broad feeling against the PRI. If you go to cinemas to see any movies right now in Mexico City, the political adverts will come up in the cinema. And when the adverts for the PRI come up in the cinema, there's often booing and whistling among all kinds of people. It's become a very common thing to see there. So that's definitely, there have been people taking on board this anti-PRI message. But then again, you go to some parts of the countryside or someplace in northern Mexico and they feel, well, you know, the PRI could become going back to Mexico's good old days, you know, the 1980s, where, well, maybe things were corrupt. Maybe we had a bit of an authoritarian system, but we didn't have groups of crazed gunmen leaving piles of decapitated heads every other day.
Again, I'm speaking with Joan Grillo, who's a correspondent with Reuters. He's been covering Latin America and Mexico since 2001 and has witnessed military operations, mafia killings, and cocaine seizures, and has discussed the drug war with two Mexican presidents, three attorney generals, and the U.S. ambassador in Mexico City. He's the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. Tell me about whether or not then this situation will favor the PRD candidate, López Obrador, who AMLO, as he's called, who many argue, of course, that he won the last election and it was sort of stolen from him. And he didn't exactly handle his campaign very deftly last time. He boycotted an important presidential debate. But now I take it he's showing up for this debate, and there's an expectation that this debate may have, I mean, the fact that the pre-candidate has been shielded from scrutiny, this is their only opportunity, right, to expose his deficiencies.
Well, López Obrador has definitely been riding the wave of the anti-pre sentiment. You know, that's his central message. You know, he's against the system. That's what his political discourse has always been. I'm the guy against the system. I'm against the corrupt politicians. even though he himself was a member of Dupre back in the 80s, before he left in 1988 to help found the leftist PRD. I went to see an event of López Obrador this Monday in the state of Veracruz, in the city of Orizaba, and you see he has got a lot of energy. You know, he really has got his old energy on the stump. He really does connect with people. He's got a very, very good discourse. He's very good at open speeches, spontaneous. He had the stage flooded with people. It was pouring down with rain, and he refused an umbrella. He was like, you know, I'm going to get wet along with the crowd. And, you know, he can joke and really move with the moment. But you see sometimes a bit of a different López Obrador on the TV shows himself. He's not always that good in front of the TV cameras with the journalists. He was on a program on Thursday on the Televisa network, and the Televisa network, as he says, has been very much against him, has been always very much out to kind of take him down, because Televisa represents the kind of interest of the rich and powerful, according to his argument. But he was very much attacked on that TV show by a panel of journalists on Thursday. And he, you know, he struggles to reply, to be very quick sometimes to reply to those attacks, and sometimes comes across as looking a little bit hot-headed and intolerant is the kind of way that they describe him. Now, after, you were talking about that alleged fraud in 2006, now after that he accused them of fixing the election. He never showed a proof of the election, you know, a fraud in the elections, which in my view was a complete proof to say we could say the elections were fraudulent. But there were a lot of things happening, and it was a very, very close campaign, a very dirty campaign against him, definitely. But after those elections, he blockaded Mexico City for some 2 months in protest. And again, that's being really thrown at him now as well. They're saying, well, this guy is not a Democrat. He doesn't respect elections. When the result doesn't go his way, he blockades the streets and so forth. So we're likely to see quite a fierce debate in which there'll be a lot of attacks against him, and he'll equally be attacking very much Peña Nieto, trying to throw Peña Nieto off balance. Now, another interesting thing which will be featured in this debate most definitely is a report which came out in the British Guardian newspaper on Friday, in a very big timing, just a couple of days before, which showed, according to documents, that these documents looked like they were showing that Televisa had been selling political space coverage, basically, in favor of certain candidates, two people, including Peña Nieto, and had also been involved in having quite a Machiavellian way of attacking López Obrador in the last election. Now, this would definitely come out in this debate, and it'd be interesting how that is played out.
So, Juan Grillo, do you think then that Peña Nieto, who has been shielded by the big media, by Azteca and Televisa, and there have been demonstrations, you mentioned we started out talking about the students have been actually demonstrating in front of Televisa, accusing them of basically imposing this fait accompli on Mexico. Before he died, Carlos Fuentes, the great Mexican author, said that Peña Nieto is too ignorant to be president. He's apparently, there's a lot of accusations of him being tied to endemic corruption, and that he has authoritarian tendencies, and that according to Carlos Fuentes, that he's simply just too dumb to be president. So that's out there. Is that going to is this the moment for him to be exposed?
Well, it could be. I mean, one thing that helped influence Carlos Fuentes was when Peña Nieto went to the Guadalajara Book Festival last November, and a Spanish journalist asked him a couple of difficult questions about, you know, what does he think about drug legalization, and what does he think about the taking troops off the street, and he answered those fine. Then there's a third softball question. He said to Peña Nieto, what are the three books which have most influenced you in your life? Peña Nieto started to stumble and couldn't name a book. so he couldn't at the moment, you know, his mind went a blank. And then he started confusing, in fact, a book by Carlos Fuentes with the author, Enrique Krause, the historian, and started kind of stumbling a bit with that. And so that was kind of one of the reasons why people say, well, this guy is ignorant. So then I think the worry for his people is if he gets caught out in something like that, somehow he kind of gets into a stumble like that. That's what Lopes Obrador would obviously love to see happen, will really try and make happen. The format of the debate itself is a little bit dry. They have quite a long time to answer their questions, not so much really fast back and forth, which could provoke that kind of thing. So and we've seen Peña Nieto, you know, he gets very well trained, it seems, by his handlers. And so it seems that in some cases we've seen of TV interviews and so forth, he's come across not as bumbling as his adversaries may hope for.
So what's your reading on this, Johan Grillo? Again, correspondent with Reuters in Mexico City. He's been covering Latin America since 2001 and has witnessed military operations, mafia killings, and cocaine seizures, and has discussed the drug war with two Mexican presidents, three attorney generals, and the United States ambassador in Mexico City. And he's the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. What's your feeling then about I don't know whether I'm accurate in suggesting that this is an extremely critical debate tonight, but that seems to be the way it's being presented. The young, you say, the students are against this telegenic pre-candidate who's being packaged but not really challenged. And then you've got people hissing and booing every time his ads come on in the movie theaters. But then you've got this kind of conservatism in the countryside. And, of course, when they rule for 70-plus years, one of their many devices of holding on to power was the many, many peasants in Mexico with marginal land would get their annual supply of fertilizer if they voted for PRI. They had all kinds of patronage systems which may still be in place. But this is a country that has extraordinary disparity in wealth. It also has one of the world's richest, if not the world's richest man from Mexico. So it seems that a lot of Mexicans have just accepted this kind of disparity in wealth and this basic social injustice.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's an interesting angle. Mexico, you know, it's a very complicated country, and it's one thing, but under the pre-rule for 71 years, we haven't seen these different parts of ideological currents in the same way we've seen some other countries in Latin America or the world. We see very clear left-wing parties and very clear conservative parties kind of fighting out. There's a good way to describe the pre is ideologically nebulous, that they haven't got a clear ideology. They can sometimes be very free market and really embrace free market things. And the other side, they can somehow embrace more corporatist ideas. Now, a lot of people actually are saying they'll vote for the PRI because they think the PRI will help them economically. The problem is that you've had 12 years now of government under the National Action Party and this great idea of an alternative to the PRI and a democratic alternative from the right, from the pro-business lobby, and there hasn't been enough growth or any real growth in many sectors. We still see the economy dominated by monopolies in many cases.
Well, just in closing, Johan Grillo, how does this play into the war on drugs? Because obviously the U.S. war on drugs is that the casualties in the U.S. war on drugs are largely in Mexico, 50,000 plus people, and somehow immaculately when the drugs cross the border into the United States, where there is the demand for these drugs and where the weapons come from that do all of the cause all the mayhem in Mexico, there's some sort of immaculate idea that we don't have organized crime on this side of the border. It's all in Mexico, and somehow we're blameless. And nobody really seriously wants to question whether the emperor has any clothes in terms of the war on drugs. What's your expectation then of AMLO's approach to the war on drugs, and two, Peña Nieto if he wins?
Well, I think all of the candidates, whoever takes power, will have a change in strategy. And we've seen that in the talking, in the debates around the election. As I said, the candidates aren't really getting into the issue of the drug war that heavily, which is, you know, surprising. This is this incredible violence, almost 60,000 drug-related killings in the last 5 years. Thousands have disappeared. Incredible things happening, refugees, groups of armed guys attacking towns, and incredible things happening. And this hasn't been in the conversation, you know, they're in a different country or something. But none of them want to embrace this issue too heavily. At the same time, none want to say, want to take a confrontational stance of saying, we want to legalize drugs, or we want to totally end the war on drugs. They don't see that as being good politics either. So basically, it's more to step away from it and take more of an ambiguous stance on this. Now, whereas Felipe Calderon, when he took power, right away he married himself to the war on drugs. He dressed up in military uniform. He said, we're going to have, like, no quarter for the enemies of Mexico and laws of big military offensive. Whoever comes into power won't address things in the same way. That's almost guaranteed. It's not going to be seen as good politics. So we've already seen that they're going to be more about damage limitation. Now, Peña Nieto has already said, well, he wants to focus on harm reduction in terms of reducing the number of homicides, reducing the number of extortions coming out often from drug cartels, and reducing the amount of kidnapping for ransom, again, which drug cartels are involved in. Now, it's more of a damage limitation strategy. It's not about, I want to take down the big capos, I want to be out there fighting a war with these guys. It's about trying to, you know, bring this down and trying to stop the critical situation in the countryside. We'll see exactly how he really achieves that. On the other side, López Obrador, his discourse is all about going to the communities, going to poor communities and saying, why insecurity is happening, people are involved in crime because they have no options for them. So his idea is all about stimulating the economy, about giving jobs to these places. And again, that's very, very important. Also, you know, I hope whoever takes power will really take social work seriously and will really look about going to some of these neighborhoods, you know, where I've been to and interviewed a lot of young people who have been becoming hitmen and so forth, and to really try and give them some offer, some hope in life, other than becoming killers for as little as $100 per murder.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Johan Grillo.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Johan Grillo, who is a correspondent with Reuters in Mexico City. He's covered Latin America since 2001. He's witnessed military operations, mafia killings, and cocaine seizures, and has discussed the drug war with two Mexican presidents, three attorney generals, and the U.S. ambassador in Mexico City. He's the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.